Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
It's a happy Wednesday morning, I'm sure, to Adam White. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Not really.
What's happened?
No, nothing. I just can't find my phone, so had it this morning, putting the torch mechanism on to try and find some golf clubs that were lying around the house, sort of crawling through the living room trying to find golf clubs because I'm playing golf today. And then get to work and can't find my phone. Now, the issue is, I have a hole in my pocket.
Dear Lila, there's a hole in my pocket.
I'm just not sure where it is. It may have fallen out.
We talk about this a lot.
It's a Chautauqua type situation. I've missed the kick today by about three or four lengths.
That's what we like to call in the classics a setback. You are a phone, like it's basically glued to your hand. So this, you can be feeling nude and naked at the moment with no phone.
I'm rattled.
So, well, just get yourself together because Sharon McMahon is here to save the day. She's Australia's greatest ever netballer. She's a big part of the Breakfast Club as well. Good morning to you, Sherelle.
Good morning. And I hate to correct you, Daniel
greatest
Harford.
Ever.
No, on the song. It's Delilah.
No, Delilah.
It's Delilah.
It might be Delilah. You might be right.
Anyway, there's a
it's
hole in your pocket.
It's 6 a.m, it's Delilah, right?
There's not that Delilah song, the whatever it is.
I don't know that one.
Which one's? There's Hey There Delilah, you got. What's the one that Tom Jones?
Yeah, that's Delilah.
That's Delilah, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
But there's a hole in your bucket, Delilah. You're right, yeah. Delilah.
Yeah, and I'm a bit worried for you about that. I feel like my left arm has been chopped off when I
dance. Got such a busy
actually, probably
days,
my right arm.
It's such a busy day as well. I need my phone.
Is it on silent too, so you can't ring it?
It's always on silent.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a massive error.
Yeah. That's not good.
So I'm not laughing at you at the situation, just the situation, if you know what I mean. That's a massive setback for you. So you'd be the same, would you, if you had no phone?
Oh, it's horrible. I actually yesterday was on, this is how much I was on a on a conference call yesterday, and my phone actually ran out of batteries because whatever reason, and then literally,
it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. And then literally a second later, I thought, oh, I wonder what the time is, and flick it on to. No, I can't flick it on because it's. I look at it so much, it's ridiculous.
No watch.
My books are on there. No watch. No. So I've been reading a bit lately. Yes, it would be. I actually don't know. So I'm actually. Feeling really bad for you, Whitey.
Can I ask you about the hole in the pocket, dear Liza? Why are you wearing those pants if it's got a hole in the pocket?
Dear Liza.
I don't know. These are my golf pants. They were there. I put them on. I knew I was in trouble anyway because it's just a bad start to the day. Quite flat.
It'd
really
be quite easy to retrace your steps though at 10
yes,
past 6.
But that's
on a Wednesday
I'm not
morning.
Close to home, so and I can't go home. Anyway, you know, there's some days you just want to start again.
Yeah.
I've had one of those days even though I've only been up for just over an hour.
Right.
That's all. I'm all right.
Well, we can't have that. We need you to pump up because we've got a busy show. I'm sure you're looking forward to chatting to Matt Kaminski a little bit later on about the President's Cup situation at Royal Melbourne, where you may or may not be heading this afternoon, which would be disappointing if you were there and I wasn't. But it's a topic for another day. And I'm sure that the Serena Williams situation at Indian Wells has caught your attention. What about the fact that it took Venus to beat her? Nobody else can beat Serena Williams. No other person on the planet... But a Williams can beat a Williams, it seems, in the world of female tennis.
She wouldn't be happy about that either because she doesn't usually lose to Venus, and I think it's been a decade since she's lost to Venus in straight sets as well. But the difference is now she's a mum as well as a tennis player.
Well, I think more of the issue is perhaps the absence of tennis as opposed to being the mum, isn't it?
Probably a bit of both.
Right.
I'll ask you a question. Who is a bigger name? Who is more important to tennis? Serena Williams or Roger Federer?
More important to tennis. Sure, I'll jump in any time. Well, there's more depth in the men's game. So Roger, whilst he's awesome, isn't as important from the men's division. Serena's the most marketable and important female athlete on the planet, I think.
No, I'm not talking about male or female.
What? No, I'm just. Well, I'm trying to break it down.
Yeah, that's
for
fine.
For me, fella, waka waka. Sorry, Shira. Who's more important to tennis?
If Serena's
out of the game, I think tennis becomes more even.
Well, I think at the moment, so if you were to choose whether you lose Roger Federer or you choose whether you lose Serena Williams completely for tennis, I think it would have a bigger impact if it was Serena because of who else is there to kind of take her place as opposed to Roger Federer. So for me, it would be Serena. And I think the story around her returning and being a mum and, you know, the records that she's going for and holds. I love Roger. I absolutely love Roger. But I think maybe for me it's just Serena. I don't know.
Yeah, no, by that logic, it's probably Serena. By that logic, which I would tend to agree with, I think, it probably is Serena.
Because I think you can cover for Roger better. Well, you can't cover for Roger, but there's
you know what you mean.
Yeah, there's more kind of behind him.
Who's more important to the sport?
Did we just answer that?
Sort of.
we're going with Serena.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think Serena clearly.
Why?
I'd prefer to watch Roger Federer play, but I think Serena. I think Serena will go down in sport as one of the greatest of all time, across male or female, but I think she is already the greatest female athlete in the history of women's sport.
Yeah, possibly.
So I think that we do get seduced by Roger because of the way he plays and the way he conducts himself. He's the perfect sports person in so many ways. But I think what Serena has been able to achieve in sport is unequaled by anybody because she just ticks so many boxes in what she's been able to achieve. I mean, we've got to remember she's been a professional athlete for 23 years.
Mm.
She's won 23 singles Grand Slams and go through all the doubles and Olympic Games and all that sort of thing as well. But then you've got to talk about what she's been able to do, breaking down so many social barriers as well. You know, we talk about resilience, we talk about all sorts of things. I think she's underrated with what she's been able to do. And now, she won the Australian Open as a pregnant woman, and now she's coming back and playing tennis as a mother. Now, Kim Clijsters won a Grand Slam as a mother, so has others. So it's not. I'm not saying that that's an achievement, she's back playing tennis. But it just adds another layer to this incredible story.
Oh, no, I don't think that is incorrect at all. I think it does add a layer, the motherhood factor. And Shira, in fact, Shira, well, you're probably better placed than us. You're the only mother in the room, as far as I'm aware. Did you come back to play netball after kids? I can't remember.
Yes,
yeah,
I did. Yes.
Was it different? Was your career different? Was the way you prepared for it, engaged in it, different?
It's probably a long conversation because, yes, in short, absolutely. And I was in – I'll compare myself to Serena Williams here for just one.
And about right, too. About time somebody did.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure I'm on. you know, I was a bit older as well. I was 34 when I had Xavier. And so if you wind that clock back 10 years, probably you're body bounces back a little bit better and more easily. But so there was certainly challenges physically for me to kind of get back into playing. And I went back to training with the Melbourne Vixens about 3.5 months after I had Xavier. So it was pretty quick. And I was breastfeeding, so I was, you know, juggling that and trying to get the timings right for that. And Xavier was coming to trainings, and there is no doubt that your mind is drawn, particularly in those early months, away from the sport in how I'd approached it, certainly for 20 years again, almost. So it was very different, and it was really challenging because particularly in a team sport, you know, you want to commit everything and your focus wants to be there, and there's rules and standards and expectations which were more difficult to fit in when you've got another little human being looking to you for survival, basically.
Fairly reliant upon you, yeah. Did it free you up mentally in any degree because there was something else? It was a bigger picture? And you knew that the sport was just a sport, even though you loved it and you gave it everything. it didn't have that gravitas of being such a big deal?
Yeah, I don't know that I realised that at the time as I was going through it, because I think kind of in the throes of it you just kind of get everything done. But I guess when you reflect on it, I think it probably, it does make you realise that there's a whole big world out there outside your sport. Mm. And when you are an elite athlete, sometimes that is difficult to see, you know, which is why it's difficult to transition out of playing in that elite environment. So certainly I think when I reflect on that, that helped kind of widen that view. But, yeah, it's Lydia Lassila is another mother that I watched go through the Victorian Institute of Sport, and she, like I did, had the pram in the gym and would literally wheel. She was doing bench press. The pram would be next to the bench press, and then over she'd go to the squat rack, and over the pram would go. And so, you know, when you're an athlete that's not a mum, you don't need to be pushing a pram around and making sure you're pulling faces and that your baby's happy when you're in the gym. So, you know, your mind is taken away from that. But, yeah, I don't think it has to be a bad or negative kind of distraction.
No, that makes sense. So the best athlete ever. Is that what you were saying about Serena?
Well, certainly the best female athlete ever. And I think she'll be in the conversation as one of the greatest athletes, male or female, of all time when she finishes. And tennis is a world sport. Every country plays tennis, pretty much. You know, it's not like, you know, some sports are only played by Commonwealth countries or no. Like cricket or netball to a point or whatever. It is played all over the world, and she has been the best for over two decades now. And, from a social point of view, the way she plays tennis, no woman has ever played tennis the way she's played tennis. She's taken it to whole new levels. And, you know, when she's at her best, she's unbeatable. For over two decades. So we talk about Roger in this amazing light, which is great because he is. He's fantastic. But I think Serena's well and truly got him covered.
We're endorsing Serena as the greatest athlete on the planet, and she lost. Here we go. It's great. beaten by Venus, 6-3, 6-4 at Indian Wells.
She's not even the best tennis player in her family.
Okay. Today, anyway.
There's a text that's come through. I should put up a poll, but of course I don't have a phone. So thanks for that text for reminding me. I don't have it on my phone.
I like the other one. Whitey, find my phone app. Come on, man, lift.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, where are you going to get the app from? It's on your phone.
Exactly.
It's a stupid app in hindsight.
Of course it is.
How are you going to find your phone if it's on
your... Someone else is meant to scan it for you. Or you got a computer situation.
iTunes type situation where you can check it.
Not enough runs in the first innings. As you saw, none for 98. I thought we were going really well, obviously, lunch. And then, that either side of tea, we lost 4 for 9 and 8 for 80 in that. And then 10-11 did really well to get us to 243. But still, it was sort of 75 runs short, 50 to 75 runs short. As you saw, if we have those runs, and we're probably short in the second innings, to be fair. Probably short another 50 there. So batting's got to improve, as we know.
Batting's got to improve, says Darren Lehman, the coach of the Australian cricket team, after the loss in the second test to South Africa. 8 days' time, they hit the Cape Town for the third test. And there is pressure on the batting lineup, and particularly two young gentlemen, Usman Khawaja and Cameron Bancroft, to produce an innings that cements them into the team. Sherelle, you would have been watching that with great interest. Of course, Kagiso Rabada has been suspended for the remainder of the series from a South African perspective, which certainly frees up, I think, the opportunities for the Australian batsmen to get on top of the South African attack. Won't be easy, of course, but two blokes with a fair bit of pressure on them. If you were in their situation or you're a mentor to those two gentlemen, what would you be doing with them? What would you say to them this week in preparation for the third test?
Well, that's a good question. I obviously don't have a lot of experience with talking to cricket batters, but I think sometimes people can lose themselves in worrying about everything else that's going on. There's a lot going on in this series. Certainly facing or not having to face Rabada would probably relieve a bit of pressure, thought, off them in a number of ways. And, I mean, you know, I always think that with athletes who are struggling for form and struggling to find themselves, they just need to go back and remember the cues and remember the things that made them good at their trade in the beginning. Because I think that when athletes lose their form, they can overcomplicate things sometimes, and I think they just need to take it back to the basics and focus on the things that they do well. Whitey, what about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that's what David Warner talked to Cameron Bancroft about after he went out in the first innings cheaply in South Africa. It was like, you know, don't worry about what's going on now. Have a think about what got you into the position where you were selected to play for Australia. And I think that, you know, when you talk to Australian cricketers or even domestic cricketers who have played for Australia, they talk about how the greatest challenge is not facing the bowler and making runs. It's actually the mental mental challenges of accepting that you're good enough and also dealing with the pressures of failure, I think, probably more than anything else. And can they put that on the shelf and go out there and bat and make runs and not let that affect them? Because I think in cricket in general, particularly as a batsman, it's that fear of failure. Mm. Whether you're playing local cricket or playing for Australia, it's that same feeling. And it's how you can actually cope with that the best. Mm. But I think the other interesting thing, I mean, because Khawaja half did get that 75 in the second inning, so I think that'll give him a lot of confidence for the rest of the series. I still think he's a very good player. But the issue is around Mitch Marsh, because he might not play in the third test. And Darren Lehman has not ruled out going and getting someone from Australia to come over and play that all-rounder role. So rather than play Hanscom as the extra batsman, actually play an all-rounder.
Right.
And they've ruled out Matt Renshaw going over and playing.
Well, he doesn't bowl very well.
No, exactly right. So they're kind of not ruling out Hanscom, who's there as the backup batsman, but talking about the all-rounder. Who is that all-rounder going to be?
Marcus Stoinis.
Exactly.
Marcus Stoinis.
And Marcus Stoinis has had 9 innings this year in the Sheffield Shield for 158 runs at 19.75.
That's not a lot.
No, it is not. But this
and certainly Mitch Marsh has probably been our most informed, outside Steve Smith, our informed bat for the last 4 months of cricket anyway. So that he's a big blow, not only from an all-rounder perspective, but just a batting perspective.
Exactly.
If you're going to replace him, you almost need to make sure that whoever's coming in is in as good, well, as close to as good a form as Mitch Marsh has been in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, your middle order collapses.
Now, the selectors have been good through the summer in selecting gut feel players.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is not necessarily in great form or the figures not backing up their selection, but they've come in and played a role and played it quite well. So maybe they'll do it again with Stoinis. But even like a young Jack Wildermuth, who's one of my favourites from Queensland, he at least has scored 433 runs at 31 through the Sheffield Shield season if they wanted to go down that path. I don't think he's ready. But if you look at his numbers versus the numbers that Stoinis has put out there, Wildermuth has got him covered. But we now know that selectors don't tend to go on the Sheffield Shield form. They
no,
go on
they're certainly
prototypes
on Stoinis, and he's the anointed one next, surely.
Well,
every opportunity he's been given.
I'd like to see him make runs before he's selected for Australia.
Why wouldn't they? Again, it's going back to an old favourite, but why wouldn't they consider a guy like Glenn Maxwell in that all-round position? Or why shouldn't they, perhaps?
Because with South African conditions, I think they're more looking at someone that can bowl medium pace rather than spin as the all-rounder option.
But Darren Lehman was saying before that they need to beef up their batting.
Yeah, well,
surely he would beef up their batting more than Marcus Stoinis.
Would you select him ahead of Peter Hanscom, who's been in around the group and been training with them in South Africa? Would you choose him before Maxwell?
And what are you saying that you think that they've totally moved away from Hanscom?
Well, it appears to be if they're talking about potentially yanking a player out from Australia to South Africa. They've got that break before the third test, so they can do it. And as people have said quite rightly, for our listeners, it's not like they're going on a boat to go over to South Africa. They are just an aeroplane right away.
Yeah, but my suggestion for Maxwell on the back of at least he can bowl, whereas Pete Hanscom's not going to bowl at international
level. Yeah.
So at least he does give them that option should they choose that's what they need. Interestingly, the Khawaja numbers home and away, looked at them last night. 17 tests at home, Usman Khawaja averages 59.38. That's really good.
Mm.
13 tests away averages 26.78. Mm. That's not so good.
No.
In fact, that's a significant drop for Usman Khawaja.
Vasant Brisha cannot believe that he sees his number up on the fourth official's board. final contribution is to be offside, which has been an Achilles heel for him this season. An interesting reaction coming up here as he turns the face. Kevin Musket, he's fuming, Besser, about being dragged here. And there's no handshake, there's plenty of verbal instead. We're going to hear a bit about this story. Besar Berisha furious about being taken off with his team needing goals.
Game between the Melbourne Victory and the Kawasaki Frontale, 1-0 win to the Victory, although Besar Berisha not rapt about being taken off in the 69th minute. Pull your head in, Bess. Tell your story, walking, brother. Get off. The coach says, goes. Matt Windley was watching it all unfold. He's got a couple of stories that we need to talk about today in the Herald Sun. Good morning, Matt.
Hello, guys. How are you going?
We're going very well, thank you. Nice to have your company as always. Just before we worry about where you're heading in the other big part of this conversation, what about that performance from Bessart last night to really throw a bit of a tantrum as he got taken off by Kevin?
We'll talk about that, and then as long as we can see how good the game was, because I really, really enjoyed last night. It was a fantastic spectacle. But yeah, no, it was petulant from Bess. You can't really think of any other word, and I couldn't agree with you more. Sort of pull your head in and tell your story walking. It's a team game. He had a couple of chances that he missed throughout the night. I think he was also a little bit furious, probably at himself, because literally the play before he came off, he would have got a stonewall penalty, except he was once again offside, and therefore didn't have a chance to get that penalty because he was well and truly offside as the play built up, and that's been a massive problem for Berisha this year as he's lost a yard or two of pace. Finds himself offside, trying to make up for the fact that he has lost that yard. So, not cool. Not cool at all. Doesn't set a good example. And it doesn't really send a good message to your team and your teammates.
Instead
of saying, I think I'm better than the player that's coming on for. What a disgrace that I am coming off for this guy. It's essentially what it looked like. So, Muskie tried to brush it off post-match and said, if I do talk to him, those discussions will remain private. But you can bet your bottom dollar they will be speaking about it. Those two have a fantastic relationship, so it's not going to, totally irreparably break it, I suppose. But there'll definitely be words had, because it reminds me of a couple of years ago, James Joyce, he sort of had a bit of a tandy when he came off one day and Muskie gave it to him in no uncertain terms. So I'm sure there'll be words between the two.
Yeah, fair enough too. Pull your head in, Bess, is the message from me anyway. I'm sure Muskie will be giving him a bit stronger than that. Speaking of Muskie, I did see him in the car park. I didn't see the game last night. I was at the Holden Centre with the Collingwood girls, and I saw him in the car park post-game, and he was about an hour and a half post-game, and he was still buzzing. He said the quality of the game was just unbelievable, and for our boys to stand up and get a win against such a quality opposition was such a big thing for his team and for his football club. You mentioned the quality of the game last night before, Matty. Was it a level above what we've seen from the Victory this season?
Good question. Yeah, probably, considering the opposition. I mean, these guys are the J-League team. So, and we regard probably the J-League as the best league in Asia, and these guys went toe-to-toe with them. They got absolutely battered Victory for the first 10 minutes, and I have no idea how they weren't behind, but they held on, they absorbed the punches in for the rest of the game. As I wrote this morning, they gave as good as they got. Come the end, it was probably a deserved win. I don't know how there was only one goal scored. I mean, both teams had about 15 shots each, and both goalkeepers were outstanding. But it was an engrossing contest. And it's what you get, when obviously you're playing against higher quality opposition. But, obviously the A-League, there's this sameness of teams playing against each other three times a year. Everyone knows everyone's tricks, whereas you get two teams that are a little bit more unfamiliar with each other and both teams want to have a go. Such an absorbing spectacle, and that's what last night was. It was a real reminder of what the Asian Champions League is all about. Rarely do they disappoint Asian Champions League games. They're so fast, frenetic, end-to-end, and this was no different. And, it just in the context of, Victory's ACL campaign, one which they have gone hell for leather in terms of, building their squad around for this year, it keeps it well and truly alive, and coupled with the other result in the group last night, it's basically all or nothing in South Korea in 3 weeks' time against Ulsan Hyundai. If Victory win that game, they're through with one game to spare, amazingly. But likewise, if they lose, they're out with one game. So there's little room for error in South Korea. They'll have to win overseas in the Champions League for the first time. But they're high on confidence at the moment. The last month has been very, very good for Victory. They've turned things around, and good on coach, Muskie as well, because he copped a lot of flack this season. But last night, he was bang on with his substitutions and his tactics. He got it right, and there was a lot of praise for him in social media land, which can be quite unforgiving, as we know.
Yeah, and you spoke about the turnaround in form for Victory. What does this sort of win mean for their A-League tilt as well?
I think, it's a good question, Charles. I think it's one of those things, as you would know, like playing, like winning breeds confidence, and it doesn't matter what competition it's in. And sort of the Champions League seems to have come at the right time for Victory in that, you know, I think they lost three on the trot as they were going in the A-League, as they were going into the Champions League. The Champions League's come along, they've found their groove, and then they've hit their stride also in the A-League, winning two straight games there against Adelaide United and Melbourne City. So I think it's one of those things where the extra games and the higher calibre opposition that they're playing against has sort of snapped them out of their funk, and then now they're going strong on both fronts, and they'll head into some of those games in Central Coast absolutely buzzing. I expect them to win that, and then they'll probably end up finishing in third spot, which a few weeks ago just seemed totally and utterly not a chance.
Now, tell me, I was reading that story, your coverage of the game last night, with great interest and with great sadness too, because I'm under the impression, Matthew, that you are leaving the Herald Sun to take up a position for the bid for a new team in the A-League in the southeast of Melbourne. Is that correct?
Yes. Your mate, Scotty Nolan, writing the story. Don't know how we got that scoop in the paper this morning. There was a leak somewhere, so I'm going to have to get to the bottom of that. No, yeah, I am. I am leaving the Herald Sun. It's with a heavy heart. I've been there for more than 10 years. Like, I started when I was 18 and sort of grown up in that office. So it's quite sad. I've got a couple of weeks to go. And then, you say, helping to head up the bid to get an A-League side in the southeast of Melbourne. So the dream is a boutique stadium in Dandenong, which we've got some really exciting announcements about in the next few weeks. The guys that designed Amy Park have designed a stadium for us. Training base at Casey Fields, where the Demons, you know, train often, and the AFL women's team plays. You know, a real regionalised, you know, force behind this. Local councils are all really behind it. We've got about 1.3 million people in our catchment area. We've got more than 18,000 registered football soccer players out here, and it's a very multicultural population. I live out here, so it's good for the family as well, but I'm so passionate about what this club can do if we get it right from the outset, you know, and build it kind of like the Western Sydney Wanderers did, make it a real sort of community team, give sport back to the people, you know, and play it out in the suburbs rather than in the cities like so much of the big sport in Australia is. So, you know, I'm really passionate about getting out into the community clubs. My first 3 months, my main priority is to talk to all 99 of our local soccer clubs in person, either at a training night or a match day, and, you know, also, and, you know, grow the team with them and make it their team from day one. And hopefully we get the tick from FFA and governments, I suppose, at the end of the year to say, one, we can play in the A-League, and two, you know, we might help, you know, fund a stadium and a training base out there, because we think it'll do a really good thing for the community. So I suppose that's the challenge in the meantime, to prove that all of it's worthwhile. And, yeah, I'm really excited, even though I'm sad to be leaving the paper.
This time of year, the sporting calendar is jam-packed. Don't you worry about that. One of the big reasons is the start of the footy seasons. Whichever code you follow, they're all getting ready or have just started their seasons. But also, the Australian Grand Prix captures the imagination of just about every sports fan in the country for a weekend in Melbourne. It kicks off next weekend, March 22 to March 25 are the dates at Albert Park for the Grand Prix. And the CEO of the Australian Grand Prix, Andrew Westacott, has been good enough to join us in studio, if you don't mind. Real commitment on a Wednesday morning. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Half. Rochelle.
Great to have you on board, mate. March 22, it's not too far away. A couple of days away, really.
Sure isn't.
Are you ready?
Well, we're ready. The engineers are working, you know, 24/7 at the moment, because a bit of a war in at the Grand Prix Corporation between the sales team and the engineering team, because the sales team's selling so much, the engineers having to build new grandstands and corporate facilities, which is a great problem to have.
So we've got really good ticket sales, haven't we?
Yeah, strongest for a decade. I think that's on the back of a huge number of things, what the team's been doing over recent years, but Daniel's season last year, Daniel Ricciardo, 9 podiums, his best ever.
Yep.
Admittedly, only one win in a place called Azerbaijan in Baku. But supercars as a championship round and lots of other things mean that we're in really good shape.
So I want to ask you about the supercars, because it's one of our favourite sports here on the Breakfast Club. We talk a lot about the supercars and the way that throughout the season, the drivers give us such great access and insight into their world. How important was it to get a championship round for the Grand Prix? Because it's been like an exhibition round for the last however long.
Yeah, we've tried to talk it up for 22. Well, this is a 23rd event. They've been there for about 21 of the years. We've talked
20
it up
years of no points for the V8s.
Exactly right. Wow. We tried long and hard, and Tony Cochran for a couple of times went over to Bernie and tried to talk him into it, but that doesn't work, and I think that might probably made it harder a little bit.
Yeah.
But the new owners, Liberty Media, and the Americans who are involved in running the show, they realised that it's all about fan entertainment and fan engagement, and they saw that Supercars was a very good benefit for the Melbourne event, and we were able to get it over the line probably around this time last year for the Melbourne 400 this weekend, or sorry, next weekend.
Well, talk to us about that fan engagement and fan entertainment. You spoke before about the corporate side of things. Which for you is bigger? Is it the average punter who's coming along to watch, or how big is that corporate side of things for the event?
Well, the corporate side's huge from a revenue point of view, but it really is the hearts and minds. We've got to make sure people come along and are surprised and delighted at everything. It's a really good opportunity for them to get close to the Formula One drivers along the Melbourne Walk, where they can get a selfie and a photo every morning when the drivers arrive on circuit. You get down to the supercars area, and they're really hospitable. And we have a big thing called the Formula One Fan Forum. So we've got to cater for, there's 300,000 people who come across the 4 days. And so it's not just about the corporates who are paying maybe $4,000 a ticket. It's kids 14 and under are free, and they want to walk around with either their grandparents or mum and dad or whoever.
Can you seriously get a selfie with the drivers?
Oh, yeah.
Can you?
Yeah, when they arrive.
I'm coming down.
You know, what we did a couple of years ago, it was the first time, and it's been copied overseas now. They did try and call it the Melbourne Walk, but we were going to charge them. But what the drivers would get off right outside the Formula One paddock. They'd swipe their pass and go through the turnstiles. And we said, well, hang on, this isn't good for fan engagement. So we dropped them 150 metres away, and then they had to walk around in front of the fans, and now they love it. It's a bit like the Oscars red carpet, and it literally has been copied in Monza and Spain and lots of other places, and it really is a great thing that's unique to Melbourne.
And I'm sure Daniel Ricciardo is right up there with who people want to get close to and touch and feel, way. But how's he going? Because he's hitting some good form coming into this event.
Oh, you're right. You must have been. They have the 8 days of testing in Barcelona, and whilst it snowed for a couple of those days, you want to be clocking up the laps to get the telemetry and the engine bedded in and all the reliability, and you want to be fast. And this year, Daniel was he did 102 laps on the first sessions and 165, which is three times Melbourne race distance on one day. And he was fastest by about 0.3 of a second. Now, there's lots of things that come into it, but I tell you what, he's in better shape this year than he has been for many years.
How important is he to the Grand Prix? Because it does seem to have been a bit of a renaissance in the Grand Prix. Is it because of him or because of other things?
Well, it was a bit because of Mark Webber a number of years ago, Daniel Ricciardo. I mean, we love watching the netballers at World Championship. We love watching international sport. Well, Daniel Ricciardo and Mark Webber are great Aussies, and so there is a Ricciardo factor well and truly at play. It was like when Casey Stoner won six in a row down at Phillip Island. You want to get behind the Aussies. Now, we've been a bit starved for success. You know, I'd love to have Daniel winning the next six at Albert Park.
That'd be good.
And if he gets, he's up for contract, which is a really intriguing thing this year as well. So he may be looking at Red Bull, Mercedes or Ferrari at the end of the season. And so it's really going to be interesting. But Daniel's really important for us, amongst many other things.
And how important is he to you personally and for everyone else involved in the Grand Prix, that the way he promotes the sport so well?
Well, for me personally, he's a young Aussie, he's a footy fan, he loves motorsport, and he helps us promote, but he really does, when it comes to event time, he really has to sort of get in the zone, and it's that fine line. It took Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton a lot of times to win their home Grand Prix. So this year he got a few interviews and stuff with us recorded pre-Christmas, and now he's just got to do his own stuff to really make sure that we can give him an opportunity of getting on the podium. And qualifying on Saturday night, 5 till 6 o'clock, is when we'll see it. And I hope to be having him up the front of the grid on come Sunday.
Who'll be challenging him?
Well, Max Verstappen, his teammate, who's a young Dutchman who's sort of taken the world by storm, and he's only 21. He's been racing for four seasons.
Crazy man.
Yeah.
He is.
He is a crazy competitor.
But, you know, Kimi Raikkonen, world champion, Sebastian Vettel, 4 years world champion, and Lewis Hamilton are probably the main ones, and in Bottas. But there's a Kiwi as well, Brendan Hartley, who's racing in Toro Rosso this year. And he's a Le Mans world champion in World Endurance Championship with Mark Webber. So he knows how to drive. And for all the Kiwis in Melbourne, they know how horses know how to race around a circuit. We've got to get a Kiwi going fast.
We're always happy to adopt a Kiwi. That's all right.
My word, they're going to be competitive. We don't want them to be winning, though. We don't want them to have a win over us, Andrew. It's about knowing your place.
If they win, it's he's from Australia.
That's it, yeah. Well,
that's exactly it.
Also, a crow situation. Rebecca Gibney.
Rebecca Gibney?
Yeah, she's the one.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everyone claims Rebecca Gibney when she's going well. But when she's not, well, that's a stinking show. She's from New Zealand. She's a Kiwi. Just on Ricciardo's testing at Barcelona, I was reading with interest one of the reports, Andrew, about the Hypersoft tyre, which is a new Pirelli tyre that they've got as part of the range this year. What can you explain to the listeners the difference between the gradings of the tyres and how big a difference that can make to the cars?
Well, you want me to try and explain the difference between ultra soft, hyper soft, super soft, medium, hard?
What's the difference, Andrew?
Let me start off half with the easy stuff. There's full wets, which is when it's bucketing down rain.
Yeah, got that covered.
Big grooves, they pump out a lot of water. You've got intermediates, which then have less grooves, drying track, that sort of thing. And then you've got a variety of track compounds, which are basically going from a very hard rubber compound to a very, very soft and sticky rubber compound. And they're all selected by Pirelli, the official tyre. And there's three sets of tyres in terms of choices that any team can have for any particular circuit.
Yep.
So then that comes into the strategy of your car and whether it's, you know, big on downforce and how it's going to wear and so on. And the other thing is that different surfaces have different abrasive characteristics. And so the wear factor on these tyres, and what they want to do is they want to get a little bit more wear, so it does introduce a little bit more intrigue from a pit stop point of view. Because if it's only a one-stop race,
yep,
and you've got to actually have two tyre compounds being used in the race, it can be a little bit boring and predictable that every car's going to come in on lap 39 or lap 40.
Yep.
But
yep,
if there's a lot of wear, then they might actually have to have a three-stopper or a two-stopper, and that introduces a little bit more driving technique because you don't want to thrash it and wear the tyres out and get a good lead because, you know, you'll have to change more often than the others.
And I think for those people that don't follow the F1s, that the strategy behind the race itself is absolutely intriguing. They should give themselves a chance to understand that. It's like watching the Tour de France. If you've ridden a bike and you think you know what you're doing, watching the Tour de France and understanding the strategy and the way the teams work together and how they get riders in different positions is fascinating. It's one of the best parts of the Tour, let alone the athleticism and the strength of the riders. It's the same for the F1s for me, I reckon, that understanding the strategies and who's played which tyre at certain given times, and the coverage does a hell of a job with that, by the way.
It's sure
beautifully
does.
Covered. And that knowing the strategy and understanding what's happening in the race as opposed to just thinking, oh, it's just the fastest car wins. It's not always the case, is it?
No, but the big difference between Formula One and the guys in the peloton is that the teams revel in bike racing and road racing, you know, they're happy when their teammate wins.
Yeah.
They're certainly not. You know, there's a domestique, and of course, you know, in Orica Scott or something, when Daryl Impey wins the Tour Down Under, the young guys are happy for him, and Chavez and all this sort of thing. But, you know, you don't get Daniel Ricciardo being happy when Max Verstappen has told team orders. But it does. It is a big team sport because the telemetry and the data goes back to the UK or, in Ferrari's case, over to Maranello, and they're getting the car tuned during practice 1, 2, and 3, which is on Friday and Saturday in Melbourne qualifying, and then obviously for the race, they've just got to make sure the setup of the car is really right. And, you know, Daniel's team is very, very good at it.
What's unique about the Melbourne course?
Well, it's a cross between it's a street course, and there's only five or six in the world that are in the Formula One circuit out of the 21. But we're a bit more flowing. I see you're trying to remember what all the other ones are. Huh?
Yeah,
but it's a bit more flowing. It's 5.3 kilometres long, so it's a typical length. The race is 58 laps. It makes it about just over 300 kilometres. And they lap in about 1 minute and 24 seconds. So the race goes for about an hour and a half without flags. But what makes it unique is that it's a beautiful setting. You've got the streets of Melbourne, but you've got the CBD so close to it, and that's why the city holds it where it does, because it broadcasts it to the world so beautifully rather than being in the paddocks of a motor racing circuit in the country.
There has been a lot of talk about it becoming a night Grand Prix at some point, and there are night Grand Prix around the world. Will that happen, do you think, or is this twilight zone the hit zone for you?
The twilight zone's the perfect place. We've dispelled it a lot of years. Singapore's got the night race. Bahrain has a night race as well, but it doesn't showcase anything like Singapore does, and that's beautiful there. But ours is perfect because what we do is at 4:10 this year rather than 4 o'clock, it beams into Asia around lunchtime and it beams into Europe at dawn. And people say, OK, well, hang on, that's a little bit early. But I remember watching Adam Scott win the Masters. Nothing better than watching live sport around breakfast time. And if you've waited all through a cold winter in Italy, Spain and the UK... Guess what? You'll be up at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. watching Melbourne when it's 25 degrees and sunny, and saying, "Hang on, that's a place I want to go to." And they look as though they do a great job.
Yeah, no doubt about that. What else is happening for the 4 days? You talked about the V8s or the supercars. Sorry, as part of the weekend, the 4 day weekend. What else is happening in the entertainment side of things for the fans?
Yeah, well, half one of the things we do is we're all competitive here. Is we go along. Everyone at the Grand Prix Corporation has a look at what they're doing at the Spring Carnival and the cricket and then the tennis, and we've got to make it better because we're the sort of last event of before we get back into the footy season. So, you know, there's 71 music acts across the 4 days across the circuit. There's an industry and innovation program which has got 7 or 8 universities displaying drone technology and robots and, you know, automated cars and 3D printing and all these sorts of things. There's 550 cars on display from 35 car clubs. And then on track, we've got the biggest track program we've ever had. We've got Ferrari from Asia Pacific, so it's an international category. We've got Porsche Carrera Cup. We've got Australian GT. You don't get a free Rolex watch from the sponsors when you walk in, but you get about just about everything else. And food vans and M-Lane and Heineken have got a huge big... Heineken Village and Black Eyed Peas are playing a DJ set on the Saturday. So it's a good weekend.
It's an outstanding weekend. And did I hear you say before that kids under 14 are free?
Yeah. So you can bring the junior footy team along and be a super coach.
Oh, just pre-season started last night, actually, for the kids. So I might just do that. Luke Matthews has got a bit on his plate. He's got to get ready for 2 big events at the Commonwealth Games, the 800 metres and the 1500 metres. He's been good enough to join us this morning in preparation for that. Luke, good morning.
Morning, guys. How's it going?
We are going very well. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate your time. A big schedule coming up for you for the Comm Games. Your form in the recent national championships was good. How are you feeling leading into this big event?
I'm feeling pretty good. My preparation since November, December has been pretty on point with just about everything I've done. Been training really good, and Nationals was a good indicator of where my fitness is at. And I'm up in Canberra at the moment, just working on all my base work, so doing all the boring kind of pre-season training. So I'm getting fit, but if I make the final of both events, it'll be 5 races in 5 days. So it's going to be pretty tough, but I'm looking forward to it.
So kept going into an event like the Commonwealth Games, which doesn't have the caliber of athlete, without disrespecting anyone, doesn't have the caliber of athlete as compared to a World Championships or an Olympic Games. What would your expectations be? You've been an Olympian, you've been at the World Championships, you've seen the absolute best. Does your expectation lift for a Commonwealth Games?
Yeah, it's got to. I mean, with the Olympics and the World Championships, they're kind of, you know, the best athletes of, you know, everyone in the world, and they, you know, that's their goal every 2 years or every 4 years or whatever it is. With the Commonwealth Games, we're probably versing maybe a third of the countries that we would at the normal championships, and we take out some of the powerhouses of Europe and America and some of the African countries. So I think the expectations naturally have to be a little bit higher. I know for me, my goal, like first and foremost, is to just try to get through the rounds as best as possible. And then, if I make the final, well, then I think, you know, if any Australian is to make the final, then a medal is a possibility. But I think I just have to keep it simple and just, you know, worry about making the final first and foremost. But I don't think that medals are off the table, but they are still going to be incredibly tough to get.
Talk to us a little bit about the last couple of months for you, because it's been an interesting process that you've gone through to come here just on the eve almost of the world titles last year. You made a decision to leave your coach via, you know, quite abruptly, really. And that resulted, or, you know, part of that resulted in you almost making the finals at the world titles. So can you talk to us a little bit about what happened, what the thought process was when you get to a point where you're like, you know what, at this point, a couple of weeks out from the world titles, I need to leave this environment because it's just not working?
Probably bit of a rough patch in my running, probably middle of last year. I'd say probably from April or May of 2017, me and my coach just started to fall out, and we're kind of at each other's necks, you know, every few days, and we're kind of not getting along as well as we should have. And there's a lot of other things that were kind of going on at the time. But when we had a training camp in Spain, that was 3 weeks leading up to World Championships, and I was training terribly. Like, I was in crappy form, and I wasn't going very good. I was also starting to get a little bit fatigued and a little bit tired from the long season. And me and my coach at the time, we had this falling out, or we had this big fight on a Saturday, and I was pretty upset about it. And I called my parents, called my dad. You know, I called my mum, and she's like, "Nah, you need to get out of there. You need to get out of there." And I was like, "No, mum, no, we're not. And then my dad called me finally, and he just goes, "You need to get out of there." And then within the next 5-10 minutes, I've spoken to someone at Athletics Australia that booked me a flight to head to Tunbridge, which is where the other team was. And then 6 a.m. the next morning, so Sunday morning, I sent my coach a text saying, I'm done, I'm out, I left. And that was kind of the end of our relationship. And then, that was 10 days out from the biggest race of the season, World Championships. And not quite sure what I changed. I just kind of changed my mental space, did a little bit of different training, and managed to win my heat, and then missed out in the final by 0.3. So that was pretty huge for me. And then, you know, after World Champs, I was kind of in a position where I had no real coach, and I didn't have a manager because he was my manager as well. But I employed my mum as my coach, because she was my coach as a junior athlete. And at the start, I certainly had some doubts, but it's starting to show now that it can work.
Well, you said that you just changed a couple of mental things, but you are underplaying that a bit, because that's such a massive call to make in such a crucial time. How important is it to get that mental side of things right for you as an athlete when you're out there competing against the best?
I honestly think that, you know, the Olympic champions or the world champions of every year, although they're obviously at the fittest points of their career or the fittest points of their year or whatever it is, but I also think they are incredibly mentally strong, and they've played out the race, you know, hundreds of times in their head before they start. And, you know, within their head and within their thoughts, they've already won the race itself. And I suppose for me at that point of the season, you know, my thoughts and my everything that was going through my head wasn't thinking about running. It was more thinking about, oh, crap, you know, how am I going to stay in running? How am I going to work with this coach? Am I going to have to find another coach type thing? But I think because I kind of, you know, removed all those thought processes kind of the 10 or so days leading up, I just tried to surround myself with some good athletes that were happy and I got along with really well. I tried to just block out all the stuff that was going on with my old coach, and, you know, tried to just surround myself with, like, good athletes. I was speaking to some people from Great Britain, I was speaking to some people from America, I was speaking to a whole heap of people and trying to get a good amount of advice from people. And then as well as that, I was at a point of time where my body was starting to fatigue, so I just tapered for the last 10 days, didn't do a whole heap of running, and somehow got to the start line fresh and got to the start line without those kind of mental concerns going on. But it ended up being okay. I just kind of changed my whole thought process and just tried to block out all the bad things that were going on. It was a pretty tough time in my athletics career, but I'm pretty proud of how I dealt with it all.
Time for us to turn our attention to the world of golf, because some big announcements today at Royal Melbourne, where the 2019 President's Cup will be played of December 9 to 15, with the captains being announced by the Executive Director, President's Cup, Matt Kaminsky, who's been good enough to join us on the line this morning. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, guys.
Great to have you on. A big announcement today of the captains, and we were being told yesterday that might be Ernie Els and Tiger Woods. Did we confirm that for us this morning?
We did. We're excited to announce that Tiger Woods will captain the U.S. team and Ernie Els will captain the international team when we're back here in 2019.
How much was that looking like being a possibility, particularly the Tiger situation, 6 months ago when he was still trying to get himself back on track as a player, that he would put himself in this position to be the captain of the US team for the President's Cup?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, a lot of people have said that, you know, it was kind of something that we were pushing for, but actually it's something that, you know, Tiger reached out to Commissioner Monahan and asked him if this would be something that we would want to do. And after a long pause, I think Jay said, yes, I think we can do that. I think it worked out pretty well.
Can he be a captain coach? Like essentially
play
and
player?
Yeah.
Had a playing captain actually with the inaugural President's Cup in 1994. Hale Irwin served as a playing captain then, so it can happen. But 2019 is a long ways off. Tiger said that in his interview this morning that it's he's got a long ways to go before he's going to make a President's Cup team. So he's going to focus on being the captain right now.
The announcement of Woods and Els being involved in this, what impact do you think it will have? No doubt, there's a lot of excitement. And interest in the President's Cup back here in Melbourne. But do you think that that will give it a massive extra boost?
Oh, without a doubt. You look at these guys, Tiger and Ernie. They've been, two of the biggest names in golf over the last 20 to 25 years. And they've had great duels, both in President's Cups and major championships. And, a lot of these guys that are playing on the U.S. and international team are playing golf because of these two gentlemen, and most importantly, probably Tiger. You know, they got into the game because of what they saw Tiger doing 15, 20 years ago. So to have them leading these two teams and leading these young men that are going to be playing on the President's Cup teams, it's going to be tremendous for not just them and the players, but for the President's Cup, for the game of golf, for Melbourne, for Victoria, for the world of golf. It's going to be fantastic.
Matt, how big a factor is the Royal Melbourne factor? We've heard Tiger and Ernie over their time in golf say how much they love playing on the sandbelt, particularly Ernie at Royal Melbourne. When you're trying to get the best players available when they're on tour all year and they're making squillions of dollars, they don't need to play President's Cup or Ryder Cup, but is the Royal Melbourne factor a significant contributor to the fact that a lot of the good players will?
I think Royal Melbourne is a factor. I think the city of Melbourne and Australia in general is a factor. You think about the golf courses down here with the Sandbelt region that you have here, and Royal Melbourne being the crown the jewel in the crown of the Sandbelt. There's something that factors into it, but the President's Cup, I think it stands, and other team events like the Ryder Cup. Golf is inherently an individual sport, and when these guys get an opportunity to play as part of a team, which a lot of them have not been able to do, but they only get the opportunity in these events, to come and do that and to do it in a great place like Melbourne and on a great golf course like Royal Melbourne, I think it just it ticks all the boxes and makes them all want to come, for sure.
And I guess, Matt, that one of the challenges that, not so much you've got, but I'm not sure whose responsibility it is, but is to make the international team better. To make them more competitive. So it's not just having two teams, but to be more like the Ryder Cup where we don't know who's going to win.
Well, I think the scores and actually the record that the U.S. has in this event probably paints an incomplete picture of how competitive the international team actually has been over the years. When you go back, 1998, they crushed them in their only win, and one was played here in 1998. 2003, it came down to sudden death playoffs between the two men that will be the captains in 2019. It came, and then in 2005, it came down to the last putt of the last match. 2015, last putt, last match. So there's been a lot of close matches, and really, if you even dive deeper into each match, they've gone to 18 holes. They've gone a long ways within the competition, and it just swung the U.S.'s way. So we're very young. It's only been around for 12 years, and you see a lot of the players that are coming up on the international side, these young players from Thailand, from India, Sharma leading the race to Dubai, Shara Shibhakar, who played well at the World Golf Championship Mexico event, and Li Haotong from China. There's some great players coming up, and I think they're going to be competitive, and I think Ernie's he's going to get these guys together more often in the lead-up, and really get these guys behind it and to come together as a team.
I guess the flip side of what I just said is that it is a real opportunity for people here in Melbourne particularly to go and see the Americans play. They don't come to Australia often, but the strength of American golf at the moment is off the charts when you think of Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson and the list goes on. If they're all coming out, it could be one of the greatest fields ever assembled.
Well, without a doubt. The US team is such great young talent. The Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, Justin Thomas, and Dustin Johnson that you mentioned. And the thing is that they love the sport. They love playing together. They love being around each other. The camaraderie is something that I've never seen before in golf. You know, it goes back to days of when Jack and Gary and Arnie would hang out. These guys actually do that on and off the golf course. So they enjoy being around each other. And that's going to be great for the fans of Melbourne, the fans of Australia to see. And they did, that's right. You don't get to see that very often, both on both sides. The caliber of players that will be here, 24 of the best players in the world, and these two iconic captains, it's going to be something to be seen in December of 2019.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.